You're listening to the Thank God for Nostra podcast.
All right, welcome to another episode of the Thank God for Nostra podcast. My name is Hottlebot, also known as John, or maybe the other way around. I'm not sure which identity is getting the upper hand at this point. Who am I? Well, I do the Coracle and Flotilla Nostra clients, and today I have with me Pablo, as you might have already guessed. Thank you for joining me, Pablo.
I'm interrupting you. Thanks for...
you're always welcome to interrupt me. Pablo, for anyone who's listening that doesn't know, has written, I don't know, what are you at, like 30, 40 Nostra clients at this point?
In hexadecimal, yes, 40 clients.
Wait, that's bigger than 40 in decimal.
There you go. Good, smart man. You cracked the joke.
But they're all work in progresses, right?
Everything is a work in progress, so even the finished stuff.
But there is one that's not a work in progress, right? It's completely done.
Which one?
Olas, of course. Your newest.
Yes. Oh, my Lord. I wish.
You have users.
Yeah. Some of my other stuff has users as well. Me, mostly. But, yeah, it has users. And, but yeah, it's very much a work in progress. Oh, man. I think just with my current to-do list, I could work for the next 20 years on on Olas. So, yeah. Again, everything is a work in progress.
That's how it always is with software. It just never ends. I'm currently reevaluating my use of Svelte, as I'm sure you've noticed. And I really don't want to rewrite all my stuff, my 30,000 lines of code into a different framework. But it's getting more and more tempting. Don't worry.
If you go to Svelte 5, you will be rewriting to a new framework because Svelte 5 is a different thing.
Exactly. That's my point. I've already moved Flotilla to Svelte 5, so this whole conversation is predicated on a question that I've already asked you, but I think it's a really interesting question and answer. So, like, Olas is basically an Instagram clone, right? And I've been spending the last year or so trying to figure out, what does social media look like if it's done in a way that aligns with the good and the intention of the users rather than the good and the intentions of the advertisers or the platform, mm-hmm. intermediating between users and advertisers, right? And one of the apps that is most often cited as toxic social media is Instagram, right? Especially from a like a young girl's sort of perspective. It has a lot of negative externalities in terms of getting people to compare themselves to other people, to present themselves in a way that is not realistic. And then that presentation makes it appear that they actually have their lives together, but, you know, they're actually deceiving other people and making them feel envious and bad. And so there's this whole like particular culture in Instagram that doesn't exactly exist in the same way in other places, Facebook and TikTok. Like, some of the same practices happen there, but Instagram is this like crystallized example of why social media is bad. And so the question I have is, why did you choose to imitate Instagram of all things?
I mean, I started, so the short answer is I was listening to Bitcoin.review and BK was saying, why is there no Instagram Nostra application? I was like, I can write that. So that's the very short answer. But I kind of started sort of like I know I can do this very easily because I already wrote a bunch of code that allows me to spin up this thing and in a very naive way write it. But the longer and more real answer, more serious answer, is that the reason why Instagram is so bad is because the medium that it conveys is very powerful. And even the people that are very frequent, regular users of Instagram, they see that it's not good for them, yet they are very drawn to use it. And the thing is that most of us are very visual creatures. And the draw of Instagram is very appealing. Like, the product is phenomenal. The product's really, really good. The medium that it represents is very attractive. Photography and videos is very attractive. But just because it is that medium, it doesn't mean that it needs to be evil. That's just the way it was ended up being monetized, especially being bought by Facebook, Meta, whatever. That they have zero qualms with being evil. It's a very powerful tool, and it's a very interesting tool. I read, actually, this mug that I'm drinking from is from a book that my wife wrote.
Let me try to pronounce that. Lo que Berta no sabe.
Very good. Yeah, there you go.
Oh, I got it. Okay, cool.
Yeah, you got it. Perfect. So the main character, or one of the main characters of the book, is actually a photographer. And I read her book maybe like a year ago or so. And I never quite understood photography. It always seemed like whatever, like you just get anyone can push the button to take a picture. Like, why is there such a thing as a photographer? And the book said something very interesting, that is that photography allows you to see the world capture the world from a different lens. Once you see photography, like good photography, you totally get it. Immediately, you get it. Like, yes, you could take that picture, but you would not see the opportunity to take that picture. So photography, I think, is a very interesting art. And I think it kind of got absorbed by Instagram. Because, you know, like this media networks, the social media has a very large gravity to it. So it attracts the medium, but then it can change the medium. And I think Instagram absolutely did that for photography.
And that is, there's so much there. That's super interesting. I'll let you keep going, but I have a bunch of questions already. So that's great.
No, I was going to sum it up with, I think Noster can represent this going back to the naivete of interacting with the medium in its much more raw form, because you cannot be conducted into such a narrow focus because of the algorithm stuff that we always talk about. My thinking always with regards to Noster, and I have a bunch of tangents, I'm not going to explore them, but my thing with Noster is that it doesn't really matter if you are creating something that is completely novel, that did not exist before. Like, that's cool, and I think there's a huge space for that, but it's just the fact that something is in Noster is enough on an invention. It's enough on an innovation. It's enough progress to liberate a medium that has value. It's proven that it has value, and just liberate it from the claws of one imposed non-voluntary algorithm. Like, that is enough. That is a very tall order. And it's also enough. It can create immense value for humanity. And I'm starting to see that, like, some people are re-exploring photography because of all us, which to me is like, there's this one guy that bought like a regular camera, like a good camera, to get in touch with photography again after, you know, rekindling the love for photography because of interacting with Olas. And that is such a beautiful, beautiful thing, man. And I'm so excited that that can happen at this stage, that can happen. So, I don't know where you want to take it.
Yeah, all kinds of different directions. I feel like I'm being pulled all over the place. But I mean, the idea of putting something that exists on Noster is worth calling out. You know, for a long time, I have been trying to articulate a value proposition for doing something like Flotilla, a chat app on Nostr rather than somewhere else. And that one's especially tricky because, you know, you kind of want the admin to have control. And so the decentralization is not as much of a factor. And, you know, for end users, decentralization even is not that much of a factor. But but Nostr, and you can make this a bunch of weak value propositions for doing something on Nostr, like, you know, decentralization, sovereign key management, interoperability, user credible exit, stuff like that. But none of them is a very strong value proposition for an end user.
Those are not value props. Those, exactly. Are tools that you can use to do something. What are you going to do with it?
Yeah, yeah. And I was talking to someone recently and you know, they kind of like turn that all around. And I don't know if I can really articulate it, but the conclusion was like, well, if you can do it on Nostr, why not? Like, why wouldn't you? How are these other platforms and alternatives better than doing something on Nostr? You get all this stuff for free. It's easier to develop because you have server infrastructure and user preferences and everything. You have users already. Why would you not do it on Nostr? And I feel like that's a more helpful articulation. It's not that Nostr like fixes a bunch of end user problems. It's just a better way to do things, and it results in hopefully better products. You know, as we move out of this like level, this kind of stage of infancy in not having the time to build really mature things. But as we move out of that, Nostr just it's a superpower. It's this extra layer of the web that allows developers to create better applications and experiences, basically. Well, like, would you get that? How can you flesh that out? Because I'm not satisfied with my own answer.
No, I think that's good. To me, the censorship resistance value prop, if you will, the interesting aspect of the censorship resistance, for the most part, is the like the flip side of the censorship resistance is the permissionless innovation, where you can go in and you can create whatever spec, and there is an economic incentive to actually spec it out and to actually create something that other people can interact with and can interoperate with. Otherwise, you are just using Nostr as a database. I think that's stupid. But the fact that you can just by yourself, without talking to a committee or anything, without getting any approvals, you can create something new. And iterate and improve. To me, that is absolutely the interesting part, because it's like a very flexible framework that is hard on the right places. So it's not too loose, it's not too strict, it's not like the app protocol, or it's not the protocol, quote unquote. It's not like Mastodon, or it's not like Farcaster. But it's not like completely loose either. There are some conventions, there are some hard restrictions, and I think it has like the right balance between being too loose and too rigid. So yeah, that's I don't know, that's the way I would phrase it.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways in which Nostr is this like magical perfect medium for developers to be productive. It's super ugly in basically every way, but somehow it's come together to be this very productive, you know, very balanced sort of thing. I mean, I think the error that a lot of other protocols make is just being over prescriptive and saying like there is no data type except for the ones that we've defined. Like the protocol is coupled to the data model. And on Nostr, that's not true because we have numeric kinds, basically. I mean, you could do the same with string kinds, but you'd get overloads a lot more quickly. You just grab a kind and you create something completely new, and the data format is self-evident. And yeah, it's kind of a pain to work from there towards interoperability, but that permissionless innovation, like you're saying, is not really possible elsewhere without, you know, writing schemas and you know, referencing them in XML documents or JSON schema documents or something like that. In Nostr, you just grab a kind and do whatever stupid thing you want to do. And if it's a cruddy spec, that's okay. You did it, and you can iterate on it later on before other people start to adopt it and enshrine it into law forever. I mean, that's where most of the ugliness comes from, is permissionless innovation results in a bunch of terrible ideas being enshrined in the law. And that's the flip side. But like, people can deal with bad code. Like, that's just code, right? Like, code is just bad in general. So it doesn't really change anything.
Yeah, I worked before working on Nostr. I was working on hole punch stuff, and there is no schema, right? It's just a transport, and you end up with all kinds of, like, there is no point where you start collaborating with other developers under a similar schema, at least not at the protocol level. Whereas in Nostr, you just go out and you see a. You can use the needs repo just as a rendezvous point where to meet other people that are collaborating on something, but on other protocols you simply don't have something like that. And to me, the strictness of the schema in other protocols kind of completely kills it, right? Because you must go through the political process. You must go through the committee to do anything. And to me, the fact that, like, those other protocols, the spec is prescriptive. Whereas in Nostr, well, as we always say, the NIPS repo is just descriptive of the stuff that exists. You're free to ignore it, completely free to ignore it. Some people do. I think there is a lot of value in doesn't have to be the NIPS repo, but there's a lot of value in collaborating in schema definitions and finding common ground, because it's really hard to just recreate your own network effects from scratch, especially if at no point you have any chance of other apps and other teams coming and helping create that feed your network effect, but yeah, I think that Nostr has like the right balance.
Yeah, the example of hole punch is interesting too. I mean, the same applies to HTTP, right? We have this transport as a protocol; everyone supports it and talks the same language, but there's no space for data modeling. There's no space for it to expand, really. Either politically or in the protocol. Like, you could potentially define more headers or something like that, but where are you actually going to, you know, canonize those or and there's not really like a lot of application level uses for stuff like that. But and Nostr encapsulates the data model. Like, the data model exists within the protocol, but it also avoids being overly prescriptive. So you have that sweet balance.
Yeah, the other thing that I think Nostr has going for itself is that the fact that most of the we are turning this into a data modeling podcast, which I am all for it, man. I love data modeling. but the fact that pretty much all we have as a tool within Nostr to do data modeling is the tags means, and we, other than you, we don't really do like rich key value on, you know, like JSON stringified on the tags and stuff like that. The tags end up being just positional indexes. This is getting really technical, but
all right, I'll bring it back. I'll bring it back.
Okay. Yeah. So to me, the interesting thing is that forces you to either create a schema that is so weird and so hard to work with that it kind of dies, or create very atomic kinds. To me, that is super important, super, super, super important. The fact that each kind has a very narrow, like a narrow enough meaning, and not, oh, it can have all these 20 different meanings, and depending on how you evaluate the kind, the tags, you branch out into a bunch of decision trees on what does the kind actually mean. To me, that is super important, mainly because it means that you can write a kind, like you can write an app that only intersects with someone else's app in one particular kind, and maybe the two apps are not very intertwined, not very related. But, I mean, kind of serious an obvious example, like a profile data. Pretty much all applications need to use some kind of profile.
But the fact that you can have a very specific meaning of the kind means that you can very easily find some data on that kind, even if your app didn't create it. And to me, that is super interesting. That's why when someone asks me for like data modeling advice on Noster, the typical mistake is putting too much data in just a single kind and crafting the data model very tightly to whatever they are trying to make, like whatever the app is. And I think most people would benefit from just thinking more broadly and thinking more atomically in terms of the data modeling.
Yeah, totally. No,
feel free to make that
human. I'll get to the human later. I'm going to dig into the technical here. But yeah, you're right. Like tags is another one of those weird, ugly things. Like it's a list of lists and it all has to be strings. What kind of a weird data structure is that? Well, as it turns out, like you're saying, it's hard to work with. It's hard to do data modeling that is overly complicated. And in my experience, overly complicated often correlates with deeply nested, right? Like deeply nested data structures or hierarchies or file systems or relationships or whatever it might be end up introducing all kinds of incidental complexity. Whereas if you just structure things as this flat thing, and like the longer I just architect applications, the more I want to just put all my files in one directory and then use a naming convention that disambiguates. And you look at it and there's one directory with a whole bunch of files in it. And, you know, you don't really need a lot of hierarchy. Dependency order is important in software. So you want at least that, like this is lib and this is ab or something like that. But yeah, but flat hierarchies are way easier to work with because they're a lot more malleable to interpretation. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind when you're doing data modeling on Noster is a lot of people fall into the trap of trying to be imperative with their data modeling. They say this thing means that this other person has to do this thing. And in Noster, you can't do that. You can't guarantee that anyone else is going to do anything. That's a very, client-server sort of relationship and paradigm. But in Noster, you just say a bunch of facts. You're like, this is a thing that I said, and you have to interpret it. And it's structured so that you can interpret it. You can get your hands around it and parse it. And then there's conventions, but you can ignore those conventions. You can interpret it differently. And so you get all this emergent complexity, but instead of gumming things up, it just reinforces the subjectivity of the facts, the subjectivity of the interpretation of the facts. Like you can mean one thing and someone can take it differently. That is how human communication works. And so having, like, I think of it as, natural law, like Noster is here are digital signatures, and this is the kind of verification you get when you talk to someone in real life. Like you know their face, you know who they are, you're not being lied to, and that's about all you get in real life. You can't control anyone else's actions, you can't protect yourself from attacks, and yet real life works pretty well. And like this is why the podcast is honestly named Thank God for Noster. Like there's all these design flaws in Noster according to conventional design decisions that, and it has created this thing that works really well and is actually almost a new kind of software development or protocol development. And I think, you know, well, Fiat Jaff obviously is not capable of making such a good protocol on his own. So, I mean, I think it's God's providence that we have Noster in the first place.
I mean, obviously.
Obviously. And we're just discovering how cool Noster is as we go along.
It reminds me. So I moved to Costa Rica like 3 or whatever, some time ago. And there was this super busy intersection in the town where I lived. Like super, super, super busy. A lot of traffic. And there was no traffic light. Like at all. And traffic in Costa Rica is you have, in Guanacaste, where I lived, you have a bunch of really big, kind of like SUV style vehicles. And then you have mopeds, you have bicycles, you have a bunch of dogs running around, you have all kinds of animals and things. And the intersection
it's just worked, man. It's insane how efficient it was. And I think adding a traffic light would have been detrimental to the traffic. It's just emergent order, you know, it's just organized itself. There were no rules. It was just completely emergent. And it really worked. And to me, I remember thinking that when I started working on Oster, thinking about how that intersection, because it's very much, it's kind of ugly. It should not work, but it works. It works perfect. And probably if you add more rigidity to the system, it would get worse.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think of the same about like traffic lights versus roundabouts. You know, traffic lights are complex. In order to have an effective system that uses traffic lights, you have to wire them all together and do all kinds of like cellular automata math in order for traffic flow to work. But then, you know, you replace the traffic light with a roundabout, which is just, it's like concrete. That's it. There's no technology involved. And you get higher throughput, lower accident rate, just because you're using something simpler that
less fatal accident rate, right?
Yeah,
so you have more accidents at lower velocity.
I think it's, it definitely is lower velocity. I think it's less accidents too, actually, because you have fewer directions that you
have.
That's the thing. Like, they're ugly. They're super annoying. I hate them too, but they're so much better because they're this simpler, more self-contained sort of thing. Whereas you don't have all this like fiat centralized control garbage going on. You know, your traffic grid goes down and now you've got a bunch of stop signs. You know, like it depends on this mind that exists outside of the thing, organizing the whole thing. So, but yeah, I wonder about Costa Rica because like, I do you know anything about how safe the roads are? Because I think they're probably more dangerous, right? So
traffic or in terms of like security and crime?
In terms of traffic, yeah.
In terms of traffic, I don't know the stat, just from experience, I would guess they are more dangerous.
Yeah, that's my impression as well.
But also just because you have a very wide range between, again, mopeds and like very large vehicles, roads kind of can suck quite a bit. The only car accident I had was in Costa Rica, and it was my fault.
Yeah, and of course, everyone, you know, is always passing everyone on skinny roads and stuff like that. Yes, so, yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. All right. So bringing things back to the intelligible, although, you know, traffic circles and roundabouts, that's always a good conversation. Could you give like a little bit of history of Instagram? Because this is something I have completely forgotten about. And it really helped clarify what kind of Instagram, you know, Olas is trying to be.
So to me, that is still up in the air. Because, you know, the biggest temptation within Noster is the fact that you can go anywhere, and you will find data on any type of use case that you want to explore. And even if you don't find data, you can create it. But to me, what appeals the most to my aesthetic sense is the very old Instagram. So Instagram used to be the photos used to be squares. So aspect ratio of one, one by one, right? One. And the reason behind that was, at least as far as I understand it, was that represented the Polaroid aspect ratio. So even the very first Instagram had a sense of nostalgia for the past. And to me, Polaroids are like super interesting devices. You know, like nowadays we take our phones with whatever, I don't know, a terabyte of disk, and you can snap a million pictures on at every instance. And one of them will be kind of nice, I guess. Probably the AIs will now tell us which is the right picture. You don't even have to select the picture yourself. And you put that in contrast with the Polaroid, and even like the old cameras, where you would take the picture and you had no idea what it looked like until you developed the reel. And the Polaroids, I bought a Polaroid for my wife for Christmas, and it's super awesome. Like, you cannot take a bunch of pictures. You take one, maybe two, you know, but each page paper package comes with 8 papers. This is what you're not going to snap 10 pictures at one moment, right? So to me, that sense of low velocity content production, and you know, by the fact that it's lower consumption, lower production is lower consumption. To me, that is the kind of Instagram that I want to create. Is not a place where you come in and there is like a million pictures and there's always something coming. Like this, I don't know. I'm getting more and more skeptic of the feed as the right mental framework. I don't think you can make a feed non-evil. It's just, I want to be able to create something where you feel good about interacting with. So that's why I brought the filters, and the filters, I mean, it's also that implementing filters is quite hard, but the filters that I brought to Olas are quite simple. They don't do any AI wizardry with changing the way you look. It's just changes. It's a matrix multiplication. So it's just a very basic way of giving different emotions to the picture, but it's not trying to augment your lips or anything like that. Like, I will never do that. Like, there is no way I will ever do something like that. And man, I've been looking at, like, since I started working on Olas, I started looking a lot at how does the Instagram product work? How does the TikTok product work? And oh my Lord, the amount of crazy filters that they have to completely change the way you look at a moment's notice is insane. Like, there is no question that that has created an epidemic of anorexia and all these kind of issues. Because within Instagram, you can say, okay, I want bigger lips, I want higher eyebrows, I want bigger eyes, I want to remove any type of, you know, pigments on my skin. Like, you can do all that stuff at a moment's notice, and it's so sick, man. It is very, very disturbing. So I want to create something that people feel good about using, feel good about interacting with, and that just embraces just their humanity, basically.
Yeah, and another like key aspect of the old Instagram, if I recall correctly, is you can only have one image being shown at a time, right? So every time you create a new image, it replaces the old one. Is that how it used to work, or am I?
I don't think so. No, they have the stories thing where it's just an expiration tag, basically, where the post expires 24 hours later. As far as I know, that was not the case.
Okay, maybe I'm thinking of like Snapchat or something like that, but it is kind of like bring up the one place that Nostr potentially doesn't work, which is you can't prescribe limits on the medium. So like Kind 20, it's not a replaceable event. You couldn't do the only one picture at a time constraint if you wanted to. And like you're talking about with the filters, that's not going to be an Olas, but another compatible client could have the same kind of thing, where they offer all the crazy filters and stuff, and then all they're doing is encoding that as an image, and so it would be readable as a Kind 20 in any client that supports a Kind 20. I'm not even sure like what to ask about that. Like, does that result in like a possible attack on the protocol? Probably. Does that result in the medium continuing to spiral out of control? Or is there a certain amount of restraint that more conservative users and more conservative clients can exercise on the protocol? Like, And you know, this gets to like the human interaction side of things, whereas technically, you know, anything can really be done if the client supports it. But from a values perspective, this people have the agency to choose the client that that implements the behavior that they actually want to use.
So I mean, to me, anything in Oster needs to be coded in a from a defensible programming perspective. So it comes down to, okay, I could create, well, I mean, you know, a bunch of spam or whatever, or, you know, kind of invalid events, or, you know, kind ones with base64 or stuff like that. At the end of the day, I think us developers, what we're doing is just we're building the tools. And we need to be conscious of the tools that we create. Try to, I think you lead by example here, but try to imbue some values on the tool. At the end of the day, users are going to use our tool or whatever tool that is compatible in whatever way they want, and that's free. So it is the byproduct of the fact that it's censorship resistant, right? So I think the tool that we need to provide is a way for our users to be in control at any point. It could be just producing, posting stuff that it's, you know, just ugly or meaningless or whatever, or it could be spam, or it could be worse than that. So at the end of the day, the tools, like, when you are in a network where you cannot ban people, it just means that you must provide very good tools for the user to be able to navigate whatever content they do want to see. I actually saw something. I've noticed something quite interesting with regards to this stuff, is that There aren't that many Kind 20 clients at the moment, and for the most part, I think it's mostly OLAS content that I see in OLAS. There are a few others, but it's skewed towards OLAS. But whenever I see some meme, it's almost always published from a different client, and I find that absolutely fascinating. It's the same kind. You sign it with the same key. It's all the same thing. But the product is different. The product that you're publishing from is different. And just because the product that you're publishing from is different means that the content that you're producing is different. And to me, that is so interesting. So, so, so interesting. You know, like the medium is the message, like the typical phrase. And I think the product is part of the medium in this sense. And it's just the fact that it yields such different results, I find it absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, definitely. Like clearly the design of OLAS is pushing people in the direction that you're actually intending, them to be pushed, which is like, you know, in a way that takes away, user agency choice in a certain respect, but you know, users don't want absolute agency. Absolute agency is sort of a red herring that a lot of people on Noster often sort of subscribe to without I think critically thinking about it. You know, like feeds, for example. Like if you want absolute agency, you don't get feeds. You just look at all the notes and decide what you like. But at that point,
that includes not even filtering by the people that you follow. That just means no feeds, just global, just everything that there is out there.
Yeah. So there's always trade-offs of giving away your agency, and in order to get a better experience, in order to select the things that you want to consume as well as the way that you want to produce. So if people don't want to produce the way that OLAS, you know, sort of shepherds them into, then they can choose something else. And that's what's good about Noster is like, you can't do that on Facebook or Twitter or something like that. You're stuck with the guardrails that they provide there. For the consumption side of things, it's quite interesting because, you know, there maybe Noster should be looked at as a opt-in rather than an opt-out network, right?
100%.
Actually, the internet is that. So I had this panel in Nostriga, and I named the panel Web of Trust, the only something like the only valid way to navigate the internet. It wasn't that, but it was kind of it went to the, in that direction of the only valid way, because you know the hypothesis that the internet died in like 2012 or whatever, and it's all bots interacting with bots, like that is going to be the reality. So I think opt-in is the only way to that, and especially with your friend Goose and all the LLMs producing increasingly more content, it's there is no other way.
Yeah, if you start with global, then how can you opt out? You can only opt out based on identity or content analysis, right? And so identity in a global setting is disposable. And so people can always spin up new identities to bypass your mute filters. And then, but LLMs could also potentially make this opt-in, opt-out ability for users easier. So instead of producing content with an LLM, an LLM can be used to analyze content. So if you have this other app that's producing Kind20s, but they use all the crazy filters and stuff, in OLOS, you can say, like, do you want to include or exclude sort of, you know, however you might define it, these other filters? Like, do you want to see people with dog ears? And if not, then, you know, you can actually add computation to support that use case of opting out or opting in.
I hate that idea. And the reason I dislike that idea so much is that I don't want to offload my analysis, my decision of what to see and what not to see to this black box. Even if I get to choose the black box, applying a filter with which I see the world, I think it's extremely dangerous. And it's very, it would be very easy and very convenient to forget that that lens is on. So I will always design products leaning towards the opt-in model, where the user is very explicitly, it doesn't need to say, okay, only this pub key, only these 5 pub keys or whatever, but erring towards the side of filtering everything out and just choosing the stuff that you actually render.
Yeah, I suppose in that case, content analysis is redundant, because the content people produce is going to be consistent with who that person is, and who that person is represented by your web of trust, and potentially mutes if you want to make exceptions to it. So interesting.
One good example of this is that I've already started seeing not super distasteful but quite some adult oriented content in OLAS. I of course know that that's going to be the case, that's just part of life. I personally don't want to see it. So I just, from my side, I just mute those accounts whenever they are within my web of trust, which is not very often. I think it happened with 3 pub keys, so it's not like super bad, but someone else might make a different choice, and they can use the same product for the same for that. It is their prerogative, you know, like the product in that sense. The product is unopinionated. You can use it in that direction if you choose.
Yeah, definitely. I do the same, and I've designed Coracle to be like as safe, pretty much as safe as you can get with Nostr without completely cutting off entire swaths, and still be an unopinionated client, right? So I almost never see any porn on my feed. It's a very rare exception. Like, it happens less than on Twitter, which is pretty impressive, I feel like. And
I think Twitter is full of porn, though.
Oh, it absolutely is. But, you know, I was mostly on Bitcoin Twitter, so I could usually avoid it.
There too.
But yeah, like there's nothing in Coracle. I'm not running any LLMs. There's nothing, no rules baked in that prevent anyone from accessing any type of content. But the user can actually implement their own filtering like pretty effectively. And yeah, like a lot of that comes from the opt-in stuff. If your web of trust is set up, then you're in a pretty safe place already. So, and the outbox model makes that possible, right? You can find people's content wherever it is on the network. But we don't have to go into that whole black hole right now. I want to think a little bit more about photography. Like you were saying, you know, just the idea that anyone can do photography because all it takes is pushing a button. And I mean, that's a sure sign. Like, what is it? If you think something is simple, then you don't understand it. I got an old Canon camera, like a, what is it, 30 millimeter something. QT, I think. Anyway, the photography wonks are going to be laughing at me. I got that a couple of years ago, and it's been super fun. I haven't actually gotten through an entire roll of film yet because I feel that opportunity cost so strongly. Like the film that goes into the camera, you have to buy from Taiwan or something like that because it's pretty rare now and it's pretty expensive. And so I haven't even developed my first roll of film after a little bit over a year. I've taken a few pictures and I've learned a ton about photography, but I don't know what the result of the pictures is. I've kept all the parameters, so I will hopefully learn something when I finally develop the film. But you know, the idea of friction that is strategically placed being something that enriches the experience is something that I think is really valuable. And the idea of cultivating people's skill as well. So if you don't have opportunity cost, if you can try as many times as you want and then automatically pick the best version, then you don't actually develop the ability to take good pictures yourself because you don't feel the pain of having taken a bad picture or wasting a really expensive roll of film or, you know, your Polaroids or whatever. That's something I want to apply in other places too, right? Like Flotilla, it's a chat app. So where can I introduce friction to encourage people to be just like a better version of themselves, right? You know, one idea that a friend gave me is to add a tab that is an AI assistant that knows the community. And so you can go to the AI and you can say, hey, you know, like, where can I buy raw milk around here or something like that? And the AI could tell you. But that comes, and that's nice and convenient because it's pulling from answers that have already been given. So people don't have to give the same answers over and over. But the nice thing about people giving the same answers over and over is it cultivates relationships. It introduces the person to the person who knows the answers. Like there's a guy in my community who just takes people on cross-country skiing trips. He knows all the spots and he just likes doing it. And so instead of going by yourself and asking Google or All Trails or something like that, where you can go skiing, you know, go talk to Martin. He's the guy. I just think that's like such a powerful concept. You know, maybe another way to configure that would be to put the LLM in the public part of the chat so that, you know, you're publicly asking so other people can chip in. But, you know, there's this like heuristic for if you want to get to know your neighbors, don't go to your neighbor's house and say, hey, is there anything I can do for you? I want to help you and be a good neighbor. They'll be like, no, I'm fine.
What you want to do is
you want to go over and you say, hey, could you do me a favor? Like I need, you know, a cup of sugar is the classic example. Or, you know, could you watch my house? I'm going to be out of town this weekend or whatever. Like ask something of them. And that like kind of bootstraps that dialectic that is essential to a relationship. So, you know, figuring out how to do that in social media, I think is really important. Social media reduces friction, traditional social media reduces friction and disassociates people from each other. So it's actually isolating, contrary to, you know, Sheryl Sandberg's sort of vision of bringing everyone together. So, you know, and like it's, I still have not found a lot of concrete ways of doing that. But yeah, like it seems such a valuable project to do, you know?
Yeah, I think it's a very valuable pursuit. I feel like just social media in general has kind of replaced our need for human contact. And I was talking to my wife about just Instagram and why she uses it. And she told me it feels like I'm catching up with friends when I'm looking at Instagram. But these people are actually not my friends. These are just random people that I follow. I just know stuff about their life because they post about it. And that's the extent of our relationship. It's a very asymmetrical relationship. But her, and just in general, the need for social contact is kind of satisfied in a way, right? Like there is, you don't feel compelled to go out and connect with people that are, like you said, like your neighbors and people within your physical community, because you have the people that you follow, and that's good enough. And there's a massive opportunity cost there. I think in general we've erred way too much towards the side of convenience. I was talking with my wife about it today. Just how often, if we are in a city or something, and even if we have friends or if we have acquaintances or family, we'll tend to take just an Uber to go somewhere. Even if someone offers us a ride, you know, like a family member offers us a ride, because you take an Uber and you can just whatever, relax, or you can read something. And maybe with a family member, you have like this awkward-ish relationship. You need to have some kind of chit chat, and you know, it's like, it's much more convenient to just take the Uber, and you don't have to talk to the stranger. And it is more convenient, definitely. And the other person doesn't have to park. They don't, you know, it's much more convenient in many ways. But there is a cost to that, for sure.
Yeah, what is it that is so valuable about human relationships and stuff? You know, like, I have some sort of like philosophical ideas about this, but it's still kind of hard for me to put my finger on as far as like what is so much better about dealing with the potentially inconvenient person in all their inconvenient glory in front of you, instead of an idealized version of that person on the internet or intermediated by something. Like, what is valuable about that? That is sort of not essentialist in nature, if you know what I mean. Like, there's a way in which people who oppose a lot of the transhumanism sort of ideas are just like, well, reality is better because it's what God made or something, but it's not a very satisfying answer. So like, why is reality, why are physical relationships and given community valuable in your opinion?
Well, I think our experience with ourselves, like you with yourself and me with myself, I am with myself all the time. You are with yourself all the time. And you see all the boring parts, you see all the imperfect parts, you see the full humanity of yourself. But when you see only the 10 minutes or the reel or the one post from this person, you just get a very small glimpse. And even when you spend 10 minutes with a person, you don't know that much about that person. You don't know their full humanity. And I think there is a lot of value in sharing uncomfortable moments of silence with someone and saying that life, for the most part, is boring. And it's just accepting that and not feeling like you need to be entertained all the time. Like, I'm seeing this, I don't know about your experience, but I'm seeing this with my 6-year-old, where she's kind of like uncomfortable with boredom. And I keep bringing her back to the fact that life is kind of boring in most of the time, and that being bored and accepting boredom is super important. It's super useful, because otherwise you are always trying to fill in all the moments with something. I think I told you many times that I've done a lot of meditation, and meditation is boring as hell. It's super boring, and kind of part of the bored. I mean, it gets to some point where it gets boring. But part is dealing with the becoming non-reactive in front of the boredom. Like, I am bored. I recognize that I'm bored, and I don't have to fix it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I like that a lot. So in a way, there's this inherent tension in existence. Like, you're in your own head, you know yourself pretty well, and you look out at other people and you don't know them as well. And you see what they're projecting. Like, you see their personal hygiene habits and what they choose to wear and stuff like that before you see their insecurity or anxiety or whatever it might be. And that disconnect is uncomfortable. Right. And you can reconcile that disconnect in one of two ways, because, you know, basically you're saying, like, this person is better than me. They have things, have it together better than me. You can reconcile it by understanding that everyone else also has an internal life and also has those discomforts. You can reconcile that tension by getting to know other people better, or you can reconcile that tension by disassociating from yourself, by starting to look at yourself like you look at other people, by creating an image of yourself that is satisfactory to you. But that is really the way of madness. Like, you don't want to become less yourself. You don't want to be not present in your life, because that's the destruction of the self, really, right? And that's really what the transhumanism idea is all about. Like, uploading your brain into a computer means that you're not there anymore. It's only the image of yourself that you have shared with the computer that exists any longer. And so the only way to reconcile this is to reconcile yourself to the fact that life is boring, that people kind of suck, and so do you. And,
yeah, so do you. Exactly. Yeah.
And I guess that's where, you know, the need for a savior comes in. If people kind of suck and life is kind of boring, you know, if there is a transcendent beauty that we're trying to wrap our hands around, like, how can that be attainable if our options are either fictionalized self or reconciling to the suckiness of all things? You know, and, like, that's why Jesus is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, and he reconciles all things to himself. And so, you know, that's why the Christian story is so compelling, is because, you know, our brokenness and our need to disassociate are actually reconciled by a perfect God who can bring us up to his level. Yeah.
And who is the only person that can actually instantiate global? But there is no follow up. That's the whole sale joke. That's
all right. So,
because I always say whenever I hear someone that has, like, a global dementia, I always say that only God can see global. There is no other global for you.
Yeah, he can. He's the only one who can be his own algorithm. Yes, he is, actually. I mean, he sees, he judges the hearts of men. Okay, so sorry to ambush you with Christian philosophy there.
No, but you brought it to the title of the podcast. I was very impressed.
gotta come full circle. So another thing I wanted to pull on, another thread that you mentioned, is, like, you were talking about how feeds are you're becoming increasingly skeptical of feeds as a medium of presenting content to people. Can you go into that some more?
Yeah, it just feels like the dark pattern of something else. I'm not sure what that something else, like, I'm not sure what's the non-evil version of a feed. Obviously, the endless aspect of a feed. I mean, it's very clear that there not being an end to the thing that is giving you data, content. It's clearly a bad thing, right? I remember when I don't know who started working on this idea of using DVMs for feeds for content, which I initially thought it's a horrible idea. But I remember someone bringing up the fact that you get a trim version of data, like you get 30 events or 50 events, not, you know, a feed. And I remember thinking, okay, that is a very nice side benefit of the fact that is a snapshot in time. This is what you get. And it ends. You start it and you finish it and that's it. And you are forced to move on. And then you compare with, you know, Netflix autoplay where, you know, they wait for 10 seconds because 10 seconds is the right amount of time. That, like, they've analyzed that 10 seconds is the right amount of time. Apparently 15 seconds was too much time. People were able to make a choice. 5 seconds was too confusing for people. 10 seconds is the perfect amount of time to optimize for capturing your attention. It is so horrendous that is what a feed means applied to that product. And it translates into human hours completely wasted. If you account for it, you could do the math and arrive to the fact that is basically a genocide of the amount of life that has been destroyed by that one decision. Same thing for YouTube. Like all these things, the endlessness of the content is absolutely horrendous. And the fact that the medium is the message, right? The fact that the nature of where the content is rendered becomes the reason why the content is produced in that way. Those are clearly all really bad things. I was reading that they are, so when they're producing movies for Netflix, they have this category of movies that you can watch without looking at the screen, because they start with the assumption that you're going to be looking at your phone while you're quote unquote watching the movie. So yeah, it's gotta be so stupid that you must be able to continue engaging with the plot, not like not get lost on the plot, even if you're not paying attention. So how the person that is producing that movie, you must feel like shit. Like you're producing such subhuman content. It's literally garbage that you're producing. And that all of that is just a result of the medium of the feed. So that's why I have this. I mean, it's not even an intuition. I can see that it's a bad thing. I'm not sure what the replacement or what's the right paradigm to use. But I think just the having a lot less data tremendously helps with that. If you don't have thousands and thousands and thousands of whatever content you are rendering to go to sort through, the problem is greatly reduced. But I'm still not sure what's the right approach.
Yeah, I agree with everything you've said. I think it's interesting, though, in big tech that the algorithm doesn't actually live up to that that goal of driving engagement. So I especially experienced this with YouTube. Sometimes it's like, I just want to watch a 5 or 10 minute thing. And so I go to YouTube and I scroll, and the front page is infinite scroll. But when I refresh the page, it shows me the same things again. And even sometimes the same things that I saw last week. And so there's and same thing with like the trending stuff. There is not actually, I'm not being shown the content that I would actually be interested in clicking on. And so I bounce. And I'm not sure if that's deliberate or if that's just large bureaucracies at a big tech company sort of overwhelming the original impetus for the whole thing.
You know the intermittent reward system, right? That is the best way to get someone addicted to something. Is not to continuously provide the thing, is provide the thing sometimes. So if you're looking for content, sometimes you go and sometimes you find something, sometimes you go and you find shit. So I don't know.
Hmm. Yeah, that could be it. I was also thinking that potentially like that phenomena of marketing where if you're shown the same thing 10, 20, 30 times, you'll eventually give in and you'll want to actually buy that thing. Maybe the same thing is going on with content. So I think, you know, there's tons of money going into this and there's tons of money coming out. So I would imagine that the experience they're providing is the intended experience, which is honestly like even scarier because they're not just trying to addict you and give you everything that you want and keep you on there all the time. They're actually trying to be in your head when you're not on the platform. To make you pick up your phone and engage again. And that's probably because once you pick up your phone, you start doing other things too. And so it's a whole ecosystem engagement rather than an individual application. Anyway, on feeds, I think like the way that I think about this is that feeds are unhealthy because they focus on a individual piece of content without context. Right. So like long form is a whole different thing from a short form feed. You can't consume long form content in a feed unless you're just browsing headlines, which is another example of a feed. If you go to any news site, you can scroll forever with and not find news from yesterday. It's all just like today we produced tons of content and no one ever reads like it's the reason people talk about headlines. No one ever reads the actual articles. And if you do, they're just regurgitated, they're copied from the AP or something like that, that actually does the journalism. And so like long form content is great because it is a complete and hopefully original thought. And it can't really be consumed as headlines. Like you read a blog post title. It's very different from reading a headline title. A headline kind of tells you all that you need to know. A blog post title is meant to bring you in and cause you to engage with the substance of the thing. And whereas like on Twitter, you've got, this contextless, it's basically headlines. Twitter is headlines, in social media. And so translating the feed to other applications, I think it actually makes sense for Twitter because Twitter is news oriented. It's journalism oriented. You actually do want, journalism, you want headlines, and you actually, to an extent, you want that mimetic, ripping off like Twitter glorifies the plagiarism of journalistic websites where if you have a meme, it evolves as it's passed through more and more people until, you know, on Twitter, it's very disorienting if you don't already understand the topic that is happening that day. Everyone is talking obliquely about the thing that everyone's talking about, but if you're not initiated, you're not part of the club. So I think it's a very interesting medium for that particular use case, but you know, if you move the feed to Facebook or something like that, now you're consuming just random bits of content from people you may or may not really know outside of context. And so, you know, what is your goal of going to Facebook or going to Instagram? Is it to catch up with friends or is it to know your friends? Because they're two totally different things. Catching up is like, these people are objective and what is happening in their lives is news. And so I'm going to consume it as news rather than, consume them as a actual person in an actual relationship. And so like, you know, I always mention, I made KeePub over a year ago, which is a feed of people and content, but it's the most recent piece of content from each person. And it privileges people who don't post very often. And I think what that does is like, if you post a lot, each piece of content represents your current mental state a lot less than if you post infrequently. Like if you have one piece of content in the last 24 hours, that is how you're choosing to present yourself. And that has its own problems, but it's a much more people-focused, people-oriented sort of thing. But, you know, I'm not sure that social media can actually do that very effectively in terms of like, here we're summarizing actual people with, you know, like we were talking about like rich internal lives, and there's a reduction that is essential to digitization. I mean, emojis are a good example, right? Like I read this book on the podcast recently, A Web of Our Own Making. It's an interesting book. I don't agree with the conclusions, but lots of great thoughts in there. And emojis are this reduction of human emotion into just like a couple of bytes. And so, you know, which one you choose, there's implicit information and meaning attached to an emoji, but there's not the richness of meaning that actually exists in either human communication or in what's attempting to be conveyed. Touch grass. I was listening to Rabbit Hole Recap recently. They were saying that Bitcoin's the only cryptocurrency that touches grass. Maybe it's somewhere else, but
I remember having the same skepticism reaction to the creation of emojis. We also used to have like the ASCII art of the emojis, you know, which were far less sophisticated, but it was cool the fact that they were less sophisticated. Because you didn't try to represent the complex thought and a complex emotion just with two bytes, right? And now you have a plethora of different emojis, so you are much more inclined to just send an emoji when you have something to say. And there might be an opportunity cost there.
Yeah, definitely. And I think emojis, you know, they are reductive in one sense, but I actually am slowly coming to like them because I think.
You bought into the like idea.
Yeah. No, but it's like it's old people who use all the other emojis, right? Like digital native people only use like 5 or 10 emojis for the most part. And they have sort of a mimetic, like a pretty rich mimetic semantic attached to them. And, you know, this is the same reason I think memes are great. I used to kind of look down my nose at people who consume a lot of memes. It's like, okay, this is sort of vapid and ephemeral and flippant. But memes are actually, I think they're a human adaptation to the digital medium where, yes, we have a really constricted pipeline along which to send information. And so it's reduced. So what you do is you attach a whole bunch of implicit mimetic semantics to any given piece of content. And yeah, if you send a frog a picture to someone, it's just like even just a frog not doing anything. It will make some people super mad. It'll make people laugh. You know, like Pepe. He's just a low. And that's the thing about memes. They're very low fidelity, right?
Yeah.
Like memes are not high fidelity anything. They're super, super simple, repeated patterns, but they carry so much cultural weight along with them.
I am a big fan of memes. I think they are super important, and I think they are, once you truly understand something, you might be able to create a meme that encapsulates the whole thing, the whole meaning. Like Stay Humble Stacks Ads, I think it's absolutely the amount of wisdom that is behind choosing those four words is insane. Not your keys, not your coin. And you know that Gigi and I started a podcast, right? The No Solutions podcast. I mean, it's not.
No, I didn't.
You didn't know that? Jesus Christ. We are really mad at marketing now. Jesus Christ. Okay. So Gigi and I started. It's not even really a podcast. We are just record. We every Friday we go on a walk, and we record ourselves because we used to kind of do this where we just go on a walk or something, and we just talk about things. And a couple, like a month or 2 months ago, we said we should like record this. So we started doing that. So now every Friday we have like this date where we go on a walk. And we started playing with the idea. And the name of the podcast is No Solutions. And the byline is Only Trade-Offs. And you can kind of, with those letters, you can kind of spell Noster. No accident there. the idea was, like one of my goals with these, we're calling them dialogues instead of episodes. Also because the podcast is finite by design. We're not committing to a podcast. It's just we'll record our conversations for the next few months and then it will end and that's it. So one of my goals is to distill the stuff that we've learned from running sovereign engineering and seeing so many people come through sovereign engineering and repeat the same mistakes over and over. Like when we started sovereign engineering, we knew less than we know now. We've seen a lot of people. We've seen many people make the same mistakes or arrive to the what we think are the right ideas. So what we want is to be able to distill this knowledge, these things, these lessons that we've learned. And if we can get there, the end goal would be a meme. The end goal, like, why shouldn't you keep your user's keys? Why shouldn't you be... So, for example, I'm not going to name names, but there are some commerce websites on Noster that are building on Noster, are building on Bitcoin. They are started by people that are... that share our values, and they're putting themselves in the line of payment. If you take a step back, you realize if it works, where is that going to finish? Like, what is the end goal of you being in the line of payments of commerce? You are going to end up running a compliance department. You will end up running a big business. You will end up censoring people. Like, what happens if someone comes in and they start selling whatever, something illegal, cocaine or whatever is illegal in some jurisdiction? You will have to censor that. So one bad decision, one bad technical decision can lead you to build a thing that you never wanted to build. And I've given this talk a bunch of times that you could make the case where Brian Armstrong didn't mean to build Coinbase. He just accidentally built this huge monster that is completely antithetical to the values that he had. I think the guy was like a Bitcoin in 2011 or something like that. Being a Bitcoiner at that stage, you were probably a cypherpunk. You probably had those values. Now the guy is running a chain analysis firm. Now the guy is reporting people to the government. And it all stems from a few bad decisions. All this to say that our idea is have the conversation. The end of the conversation, we can make it. Hopefully, the idea is that I don't think we can evolve the idea, but the end product must be a meme. It must be something that you can say in four words, and anyone can understand why being in the line of payment is a bad idea. Why building a REST API? Why building a centralized server that acts as this middleman for your product? Why is that a bad idea? Because in Bitcoin, we have a very rich history of arriving to these conclusions, to these ideas, like not your keys, not your coins, and these things. Because we've been, like so many people have been burned so many times, that we can recognize the category of error. Like you see FTX and you see like three different category error. You don't need to really dig deep into their books. Like you can see, okay, they're producing their own shitcoin. Okay. Like it's clear. Okay. It's bad because of this. You know, like you don't have left side of the curve can put in a category the type of error that they're making. And in Noster, we don't have the richness of those memes. And I think a meme is absolutely fundamental, because anyone, like, you don't have to have been burnt to be able to understand the meme. Anyone can understand the meme.
That's a great project. I like that a lot. And the trade-off between high fidelity, lots of information, and low fidelity. I don't know. There's like almost an inverse relationship, right? With high fidelity stuff, you're bombarded by information, and so the meaning is very low. You have a high or a low signal to noise ratio. Whereas if you have very little information, the meaning can actually outweigh the information by a lot. How long did it take to develop a lot of those memes in the Bitcoin space? Like 10 years, something like that?
I don't think 10 years. I'm not sure, but I don't think 10 years. Yeah, definitely not 10 years, because Not Your Keys, Not Your Coins was already existed when I got into Bitcoin. So yeah, definitely. I don't see that that tension the way you, the way I think you're describing it. I think a meme is more like a compression algorithm. You're just compressing a bunch of wisdom into a few words. But some words where you put them together, they can yield a much denser amount of information. I read this short story once in Spanish. I'm trying to remember it and translate it. It was something like on a classified baby stroller, brand new. And that, like, you understand within the setting of selling a used stroller, but it's brand new. Like, you understand what happened, right? And it can yield. It was in Spanish was written much better than that. But you can feel it. Like, oh Jesus Christ! Okay, that is very impactful. And it's just a few words, right? So there is again, it's just a compression algorithm.
Yeah. And, you know, that matches with my experience of getting into Bitcoin. You know, Ron Paul, I voted for him twice back in 2008, 2012. I kind of grew up with that libertarian mindset. But it clicked when I listened to Robert Breedlove expound the properties of money. It's not quite a meme, but it is something very short. You know, you can enumerate the properties of money in under a minute. And that made 20 years worth of conditioning click for me, and I became a Bitcoiner like that moment. So the person doesn't have to understand all the stuff behind it. It can help crystallize it, but it can actually communicate new information as well, which is really interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah, to me, I read Human Action in 2006. I learned about Bitcoin in 2011 or 12 or something like that. Like, I read it on Slashdot, so whatever it was published on Slashdot. I interacted with Bitcoin. I was working on a hosting, as a CSOPS on a hosting company many years ago, and received some Bitcoin payments and stuff like that, but I never saw it as money. And it took me until Stefan Libera to make the connection between Austrian economics and Bitcoin. Like, I had never seen it before. But I had all that information, you know, but I didn't have it in condensed enough form to mash it together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, Odell, I think, talks about the Stay Humble, Stack Sats, all those memes as mantras as well. And I'm not very familiar with the philosophical tradition that really includes mantras, but like a mantra is something, I don't know. How would you define a mantra? Like, can we look at it from that direction too? Are memes mantras, or are they different things?
I don't know. Like, my idea of a mantra is just comes from meditation, and I hate meditation based on mantras. I think it's
okay.
Not cheating. I mean, it's kind of cheating yourself.
I feel like it's a way to abridge creative thought, potentially. Like, a mantra is a way to narrow your scope so that you're not distracted by things. Because you can be distracted. You can be talked out of correct positions, right?
Uh-huh.
So I don't know. Maybe that's what the function is. But yeah. Well, I think this is a good place to leave it. Do you have a mantra for everyone listening? A meme. Do you have any memes, or are you still workshopping memes with Jesus?
I started writing this article called the Tao of Noster, but I don't remember any of them. the only one that I remember is either build a software or run it. Like, don't build and run the infra yourself. But it's not quite a meme.
Well, you've inspired me. Maybe I'll try my hand at writing some memes.
You are a good writer. I think writing memes is requires a different skill set, because it's all about compression.
Not much of a tweeter, so I don't expect much. But
I'm not much of a tweeter myself. Yeah. By the way, I disagree with what you said before. You just went off, but I disagree with what you said before. I don't think Twitter is headlines. I mean, I think shitty Twitter is headlines. I think Twitter, I think articles and blogs are shitty tweets. Like you read, you can see a lot of long forms, like on Medium or whatever. So like any long form that should have been a tweet, it would have been much more impactful as a tweet. But or the author might feel that the high velocity of Twitter is a bad medium for a short amount of text. But I think if you can say it in 40 words, man, that's phenomenal. That's much better than if you have to use 400 words. If you can say in 20, that's even better. As long as you're not losing so much that you lose all meaning. But I just think most long forms could have been a tweet.
Yeah, I agree. That's what people say. Like all the work in writing is in the editing. And if you can whittle something down to 1/10 the size, it's going to be 10 times as good. So yeah, I think I agree. Like you're right. Like headlines are just bad tweets, but they still kind of like form they still kind of fill that function of a tweet in condensing a certain amount of information into something that is intelligible and informative. So yeah, cool. Well, thanks for coming on, Pablo, and having that conversation. I really enjoyed that.
Me too. Thank you, sir. Thanks for having me.
Well, all right. We'll see y'all all on Nostr.
See ya.